Okay, this is being live streamed.
Good morning from the Kadamba Center, Gompa.
Good morning, Gompa. Okay, Giovanna.
Hello.
Good morning, Giovanna. Good morning, Nili. Long time no see. Nili, were you the one who took me out to dinner one night?
Yes.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too, Venerable George.
Rainey Parker, Jessica. So wait a minute. Donna, are there some obligatory prayers you want to say first?
There are no obligatory prayers, Venerable George. So we can, you can set an intention and do the dedication however you choose. We have ones that we normally do, but we're flexible. So
okay,
it's
excellent.
Your choice.
Okay, so I'll probably lead one. Good morning, Nico. Where are you? Are you in Raleigh?
Philadelphia.
Okay. And Felix, where are you, Felix?
I'm from here in Cary.
And Cary, okay, you're in close there. And Muruganandam.
Good morning. I'm from Cary.
Could you say your name?
Muruganandam.
Wow, Indian name, right? Or Sri Lankan or what?
No, from India.
From India. Good to hear you.
Thanks.
Jessica. And Robert Watkins, someone I know.
Yeah. Good morning.
So we still have 1 minute, 45 seconds before we start. Tenzin Lamo is coming on. Has the Italian nun, Sangha member, has she been around recently? Or is she off?
Oh, Venerable Kondo?
Kondrola, yeah.
Yeah, she's around. She usually watches on YouTube.
Okay, maybe we'll see her. She'll see us. Good morning, Tenzin Lamo. Good morning, Meredith Das and Jessica. Okay, so this is our Sunday morning go to temple. What do they say in the South? Go to church. Sunday morning, go to church. So my name is George. My sort of ordained name is Gelong Thubten Sultram, but because that's a bit of a tongue twister, people just call me Monk George. So it's easier. I go by either. So we're going to be talking this morning about how to be happy in samsara, which is, I mentioned to Donna earlier, not an easy task. Good morning, other people that are coming in. So to begin with, rather than doing formal prayers, which have great utility, great meaning, we're going to do a little bit of meditation on the topics of those prayers to try to set a motivation as close as we can to a special virtuous motivation. If some of you are beginners, you may not know the term bodhicitta, but maybe all of you do. Maybe some of you are actual bodhisattvas who have bodhicitta. I don't know. But we'll try to set a positive motivation. So sit comfortably. I have to remind myself, relax the body, relax your mind. Relaxing the body is pretty straightforward. We understand that. Relaxing the mind, I think of as reminding myself that I don't have to think about anything else right now. All the plans and worries you can temporarily let go of. And first of all, pay attention to your respiration, your breathing, without controlling it. Just like you're listening to a bell that's chiming. And once you've recognized it, apply the mental factor mindfulness, which means keeping it in mind. Mindfulness is a mental factor that, having once recognized something, keeps it in mind, keeps it in memory. Like the Buddha, in many of the sutras, they began that he had gone out for alms in the village, came back, washed his feet, sat down, and placed his attention on the breathing in front. So that's what we're going to do first of all. You add a little wisdom component to your mindfulness, recognizing when you're breathing in and when you're breathing out. See if you can withdraw your attention away from your eye consciousness, which is quite dominant. There will be some light coming in your eyes. Away from your body consciousness, which might have some aches and pains. Like a turtle or tortoise withdrawing its head and limbs within the shell. Bring your attention to your center of your body, maybe around the area of the middle of your chest, what we call the heart chakra area. Pay particular attention to the breath when it just reaches its apex on the inhalation and on the exhalation, just when it's changing directions. Don't let your mind wander. See if you can see that transition, recognize that transition. If you've begun to calm your breathing, find your mind a little calmer. Now bring your attention away from the breathing and place it instead on the mental consciousness, which is hard to recognize. It's formless. So we first recognize it by its contents, the thoughts, the images, inner conversation, memories, plans, observations about the present. All of these are contents of your mental consciousness. And so you can start to get an idea of it. It's that entity within which the thoughts, images, sounds, and so forth arise in your mind, memories, plans. Watching the spaciousness of the mind between the thoughts. The quiet, the calm. Try to focus on that. Depriving other thoughts of their vitality. That is, if you don't pay attention to the thoughts, they begin to dissipate. They begin to diminish in intensity and in frequency. Again, withdrawing your attention away from your eyes and ears, nose, tongue, and body consciousnesses, as though you're hunkering down in a little cave in your heart chakra, in the middle of your chest. Just watching this clear nature of the mind. The consciousness does not obstruct thoughts from entering. There's no viscosity, so to speak, no friction. Thoughts can leave in an instant. If we're skillful, we can let go of unhappiness and other thoughts. Our anger, attachment, jealousy, pride, low self-esteem, worry, are all transient events. They're not the very nature of the mind. Once we know the antidotes to those negative states of mind, disturbing states of mind, we can cause them to disappear temporarily. And we can replace them with positive states of mind. Faith, love, compassion, wisdom. This clear nature of the mind, clear light nature of the mind, is called the conventional Buddha nature, or Buddha potential. Ultimate Buddha potential is the emptiness of the mind, the shunyata of the mind, but the just this recognizing this conventional clear light nature is called recognizing the conventional Buddha nature, which is also called the developmental Buddha nature. Think for a moment, I can develop all of these qualities that I don't have yet. I can enhance those that I do have. Good qualities. because the mind is not, does not provide any obstacle to these states of mind from arising. Also, I can eliminate all my faulty states of mind, my resentment, grudges, and strong attachments, and dissatisfaction. The mind offers no hindrance, no obstacle to those states of mind, we would say, reabsorbing into the consciousness, like a cloud on a sunny summer day that is heated by the sun's rays. As it disappears, it's not as though it goes to another location. It just absorbs back, the moisture absorbs back into the air surrounding it. I can become a better person for myself and for others. I can verify that by recognizing this clear light nature of the mind. And that brings a sense of joy, of what we might call Dharma happiness. I have this ability right now because I have a life as a human that's special, which what can be called life of leisure and richness, leisure and endowment. I'm at leisure, I'm free from unfree states when we were born as a hell being or as an animal in the past, or as a long-life God, long-lived God, that wouldn't have the ability to practice the Dharma. Our life right now has great potential, great meaning to help us escape from cyclic existence. This has come about because of actions we've created in the past lives, but it is impermanent. With every instant, we're getting closer to our eventual demise, our eventual death. And we don't know where we're going to be reborn. So thinking to make use of this opportunity while we're alive with a life of leisure and endowment, we can develop positive states of mind that make us more calm and peaceful, more loving. We can create states of mind where we become less a problem for others because of our bad actions, our anger, mindlessness. But the supreme way of making use of this life, as the Buddha himself taught, was to recognize that all living beings are exactly equal to us in wanting to be happy, wanting to be free of suffering. All the beings that we might now categorize as strangers, or maybe as enemies, or at least, even if you don't use the word enemy, those that we feel some discomfort with in their presence, all of them, as well as our family and our friends, our loved ones, our mothers and fathers. They have all equally been our mother in numberless lives in the past. Just as our present mother has been depthlessly kind as mother again and again and again in cyclic existence in the past, every sentient being is exactly as kind as our present mother, having been our mothers in other lifetimes. Those that we call sentient beings are still caught in cyclic existence. To feel some empathy and compassion for them, even a responsibility to repay their kindness in numberless lives in the past, intimately feeling their plight because we feel the suffering of cyclic existence. Buffeted by our delusions and karma, think how wonderful it would be to eliminate the suffering of all sentient beings through training their minds and leading them into everlasting happiness. You can start with your parents, your loved ones, and spread out to strangers and to enemies. It would be wonderful if all living beings were free of suffering and had everlasting happiness. But to be able, I can't do that right now. I can barely help myself. To do that, we would have to progress on the spiritual path, and to be able to help all living beings, even those in the higher spiritual levels, we ourselves would have to achieve perfection. We would have to become an enlightened being, a Buddha, an omniscient being. That is said to be with the thought of achieving that for the sake of sentient beings is said to be the most virtuous of mental states, what we call bodhicitta. See if you can develop that, just an inkling of that thought. I will become a Buddha in order to remove sentient beings from the ocean of samsara and place them into everlasting bliss of Buddhahood themselves. To do that, we need to know the mind. We need to know about the teachings of the Buddha. So think, make a motivation. I'm going to participate this morning in listening to some talk of the Buddha Dharma, not just to have more knowledge alone, but as a means to tame my mind, to get closer to enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. I'm going to listen to the teachings in order to become enlightened for the sake of all mother sentient beings. And then bringing your attention back to the present, relaxing your body, mind. Good morning, everyone. Someone said something I didn't hear. Say again. something like Spanish or something. Okay. So, as I introduce myself, some of you have come in since then. I'm Monk George Chernoff. Okay, I hear some back talk there. You also called Tupten Sultram, but as I joked before, that it's a bit of a tongue twister. So people, I suggest people stick with George unless you are familiar with pronouncing Tibetan words. So Geshe-la is having a little, as I understand it, a little staycation. Do you use that word? So he has a chance to relax a little bit. So I'm going to talk a little bit about quite a difficult subject, actually, how to be happy in samsara. You know, is it possible? What do you think? Someone's subtly, Elise is subtly nodding. Anyone think it's not possible to be happy in samsara? David Stravel, what do you think? Is it possible to be happy in cyclic existence?
Yes, I think so.
Okay, so from a Buddhist point of view, the usual happiness that we experience, you know, you might say, oh yeah, I have ice cream, I go down to Culver's, or I can't remember that nice ice cream store that Robbie and Don used to take me to where you get the concrete. What is that one, Robbie?
Goodberries.
Goodberries, yeah. Yeah, that'll make me happy. But is that from a Buddhist perspective? And Giovanna, I think, is saying that wouldn't make her happy. That kind of happiness is what the Buddha called contaminated happiness. And by its very nature, it's just the substituting of one suffering for another. The desire for good berries or blueberries, whatever it was. And when you eat enough of it, your mouth becomes saturated, your belly becomes full, and it turns into obvious suffering. That kind of happiness is not reliable. It's the cause of, you know, sort of like drinking salted water, causing you to have more thirst, you know, to energize or to elongate your stay in cyclic existence. So from a Buddhist point of view, how to be happy in cyclic existence really gets down to how to find uncontaminated happiness. Happiness that doesn't have that kind of defect of changing into suffering. When you've watched the famous Keanu Reeves thing about the
Matrix.
The Matrix, yeah. You watch the whole Matrix trilogy or something like that, and your mind has become, you know, saturated at the end. It doesn't, you know, it's changed into suffering. How can we begin to find what we can also call Dharma happiness, even if it's not totally uncontaminated? Here, uncontaminated means a not contaminated by a part of our mind, a kind of ignorant part of our mind that is grasping to a real self, you know, real Emily, real Tenzin, real Nico, you know, as though there was a real substantially existent or inherently existent person, someone really there. That's the contaminating factor. When we grasp to ourself or we grasp to outer things, our cars, our food, our companions and so forth, is existing the way that they appear, somehow existing from their own side without the need of our mind labeling their appearances as this or that, really believing that the computer exists out there without my, you know, there is the appearance of the computer, but our mind seems to think that there is a real computer there existing from its own side. I can see my own hand. I don't know if you can understand what I'm doing with my hand. So from the side of the object coming toward us, actually, the Buddha taught that appearances arise due to our karma from past lives. And our mind sort of projects upon them as though they had some kind of inner essence out there to be found. That's a contaminating factor here, you know, in terms of ourself, as though there seems to be a self within ourself, and our mind projects upon it as though it really is there by its own side, from its own side. Even not needing to get rid of that contaminating ignorance, which would be a very high, developing that kind of understanding is a good Dharma realization, very advanced Dharma realization, just to have what we could call Dharma happiness. So what I'd like to propose is that Dharma happiness is a state of mind where we've subdued our other afflictions, what the Buddha called klesha. Anyone know that word? Felix, do you know the word klesha, what klesha means?
I do not. I've heard it, but I don't know what it means.
Okay. So in Sanskrit, they say it's pronounced klesha. In Pali, I think, maybe some of you know klesha. Maybe there's an added syllable there. But what it means is a state of mind which disturbs the calm and clarity of your mind. Sometimes people in earlier times have translated it as delusion. Sometimes people might call them emotions, but we might think some emotion, like love is an emotion, right? But maybe emotion from a Buddhist point of view is not such a good translation. I don't know. Disturbing, Lama Sopa Rinpoche translates it as disturbing state of mind. It's a state of mind such as anger or attachment, jealousy, pride, resentment, low self-esteem, that causes what previously was a maybe clear and calm state of mind to become disturbed. That's what a klesha is. That's what a affliction is. We can call them affliction, mental affliction. Classic example that the Buddha gave us of a stream of water, pure water, that is clear and is sort of, you know, even though it's maybe moving, or a pond, even if it's not moving, clear, the dirt has fallen to the bottom and the surface is nice and calm. if the king's cavalry were to run their horses through that after the, 20 horses have run through, the water is turbulent and the dirt from the bottom has mixed into the water. So this is an analogy to this, that the mind has become less clear, like the dirt coming up, other afflictions rising. When one affliction rises and you start to think in unproductive ways. So there's a technical term, they say, inappropriate attention. I'm thinking, that's really beautiful, or that's terrible, as though there were, your mind is exaggerating the faults or qualities of something, causing the mind to become more unclear. And the mind becomes agitated. It's not so easy to calm down again if you're angry, or if you're super attached to something, you're super excited about something. Maybe moms and dads will know if the kids are really excited about Christmas or something, hard for them to fall asleep at night. It's not just anger that can keep you from being calm. So Dharma happiness, we could say, even though it's maybe not an uncontaminated mind, maybe we still have ego grasping or grasping to reality as inherently existing, really existing, but we've subdued our delusions through, applying mental practices. Like, say, for instance, watching the clear light nature of your mind. My name is obscuring my thumb here. I'm trying to put it at my heart chakra. Sort of, watching the mind, recognizing that the mind, by its very nature, is spacious and clear, and it's only when we've cultivated, we've allowed afflictions, delusions, klesha to enter into it, that it becomes unclear, harder to make decisions because of that unclarity, like the inability to see through the water because the dirt has come into it. We can't make decisions wisely when the afflictions are present. And we feel uneasy. The inner turmoil translates to a physical unease. Right? Do you notice that? Is it easy to feel when you're really angry? I don't know, I won't ask, or if you're really attached, is it easy for the body to feel comfortable at that time? Oftentimes, if we do have some physical ailment, it makes them more prominent in our mind. We're more irritable and irritated. So one goal of how to be happy in samsara, until we advance more on the spiritual path, on the Buddhist path, is to try to bring about a state of Dharma happiness, where we let the delusions, we apply antidotes to temporary or temporal antidotes to the delusions. If they're prominent, if they're not so prominent, we can just ignore them for the time being. Like I said at the beginning of our meditation, reminding yourself you don't have to think about anything else. Like, for instance, I haven't applied for my Medicare insurance yet. I think Tuesday's the deadline. So at the beginning, right now, I'm going to forget about that. Otherwise, my mind nagging in the back of my mind, something like that, right? Before I go any further, anyone have any observations, any questions? Now, I can't see all the screens, but I think if you put up, there's a little icon you can put up like a hand. It sort of transports you to the top where I might be able to see you. Anyone have a thought, a question or observation? Oh, Naga.
I see here it says, I study yoga, so it says five kleshas.
Uh-huh.
They are in Sanskrit. Avidya,
ignorance.
Asmita is ego.
Uh-huh.
And raga is attachment. And aversion is dvesha. And then the fear of death is abhinivesha.
So that's pretty close to the Buddhist interpretation. Some of those raga and avidya. Avidya is the negative of vidya, right? Vidya means knowing, knowledge. So avidya means not knowing. From a Buddhist perspective, the worst kind of not knowing is not simply being unaware of something, like not knowing the population of the Netherlands or something like that. You say, I'm ignorant. That's not so bad. What's the worst kind of ignorance is the ignorance that is actually an active kind of wisdom, which is misperceiving something, misperceiving that there's a real ego inside. It's a misdirected wisdom. That's actually called ignorance. So usually the Buddhist enumeration of the klesha, we talk about six main ones. We talk about ignorance, attachment, anger or hatred, pride, and a kind of doubt where you're not quite sure about something, but you're thinking it's like you might think, maybe karma works. Maybe I will experience the results of my karma. Maybe not. Probably not. The mind that thinks, the doubt that thinks in the wrong way is one of the klesha. And then the sixth klesha is what we call wrong views, which would include the ego, grasping to the ego that you'd mentioned in the list, Naga. Now, one other gentleman had, you continue it, Naga. Yeah, I was going to ask, there's another gentleman who had his hand up. I didn't call yet, so you put your hand up again and I'll call you right afterwards.
I don't have any more.
I thought you were, yes. Okay, Nico, right, Nico, what were you going to say?
So, I was going to ask, is being in the present mindfulness, is that a primary antidote to many klesha? I'm not sure how to put that in. Or is it just one of the steps towards dealing with it? The antidote.
Right. Good question. So, by the way, the word klesha, the way we would write it in Roman characters in our alphabet is K-L-E-S-H-A, you could say. Klesha. So very popular nowadays is the practice of mindfulness, right? From your point of view, from your understanding, Nico, am I pronouncing that right? Is it Nico or Nico? Nico?
Either one.
Nico, what do you understand a Buddhist mindfulness practice to, what does that mean?
Not getting lost in the past or the future, being in the present and, sort of separating yourself a little and being able to, perceive.
Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, through a sort of a deeper, more informed, less contaminated perspective.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so those are good qualities. So letting go of the past and future thoughts. Remember in our motivation at the beginning, I'm not sure if I mentioned, one of the things is let go of thoughts of the past, thoughts of the future. And but say, for instance, if one thought that was a major element, you can still get angry about the present, right? The bee just stung me, or someone just shortchanged me, or someone called me a bad name. Even though you're not thinking about the past or the future, you can still be, if you're just trying to dwell in the present, that's not enough. Generally,
by present, I mean, you know, like your experience that somebody calls you a bad name, right?
Right.
You don't react based on habit, or, you know, you sort of have a larger, clearer idea of what's actually happening.
Right, right.
And you're able to respond based on that rather than a guttural or a instinctual or a habitual source.
Right, right. So that's an excellent answer to sort of my sort of, what was it called, you know, sort of like the devil's advocate, so you still get angry in the present. That's a good, so generally in Buddhism, when we talk about mindfulness, it's important in developing single-pointed concentration and other qualities to keep something in mind, not being distracted by other things. But generally there are four objects of mindfulness, very, very important in all of Buddhism, but particularly in the Pali tradition and in maybe the Theravada tradition, that has informed a lot of the present day psychological research about mindfulness meditation, you know, mindfulness. Do you know what those four objects are? Is anyone? So a couple of heads turning back this way. Anyone know? Meredith, you're saying that. William, do you know? What are the four objects of mindfulness that I'm thinking of? They're called the four close placements.
The four objects are breath.
You, right?
Focusing on the breath or the body. Second is the feelings. Third is mind. Fourth is phenomena, quality of phenomena.
Right. Hey, good. Hey. Robbie's impressed also. Did you know that, Robbie? You knew that, right? They're called the four close placements of mindfulness. So the close placement of mindfulness on the body, as William said, includes watching, being mindful of the breathing. That's what we did at the very beginning, right? It's actually called close placement of mindfulness on the body. Also, close placement of mindfulness in the body includes, you know, as you've seen in the Theravada retreats, or maybe you've done, or you do walking meditation, you know, you put your foot up, you're mindful of the foot rising and going down and so forth. That's also included in close placement of mindfulness on the body. What other kind of practices? Anyone know? Have you ever done eating meditation at a Theravada retreat? You know, your spoon comes up and open your mouth and your tongue touches and so forth. Mindful of all of the various steps of that. That's also included in close placement of mindfulness of the body. Close placement of mindfulness of the feelings would be mindful of your feelings as being arisen from contact with something, you know, something like a substance, or seeing a person that you like or that you dislike, causing, you know, the pleasant or unpleasant feelings to arise. Recognizing that the cause of those feelings are the delusions. Simply coming in contact with something doesn't necessarily bring a feeling. It's when the mind responds to that as being attractive or unattractive. So that's sometimes said to be an entry into the second noble truth, the cause of suffering. And then as William said, the close placement of mindfulness on the mind, like we did in the last part of our meditation, looking at the clear light nature of the mind, watching how it's changing from moment to moment, how it's it has no obstruction, no obstructing qualities. And the last placement of mindfulness on phenomena means recognizing that phenomena themselves, all things are impermanent and empty, selfless and so forth. So from so getting back to Nico's question, in the Theravada tradition, sometimes that, and maybe even modern psychology, almost sounds like they think that's the end game. That is, from a Buddhist perspective, that's one step along the path. In the, do you know the Satipatthana Sutra? Has anyone heard of the Satipatthana Sutra? Put your hand up. Naga has. No one else? I can't see every, I don't see every, let me see, is anyone else? Anyone else? I can't see every face at once. So the Satipatthana Sutra, Sati is a Pali word that is equivalent to mindfulness. In Sanskrit, it's actually a little different pronunciation, Smriti. Anyway, Satipatthana means holding the mind, the mindfulness, close placement of mindfulness. In that sutra, it says, this is the one path. So sometimes people, kind of in answer to Nico's question originally, might say, oh, mindfulness, yeah, that's all you need. That's all you need. But of course, what did Jesus say? I don't know, any Christians said it. I am the way and the path. Other than me, there is no other way to God. Something like that. What is it? Who's a Christian scholar? Peter, you're nodding your head a little. How's it go? You have to unmute.
Yeah, it sounds familiar. I can't remember the exact quotation, but I am the way and I am the path, I believe.
Emily has a fresh idea.
Yeah, I think it's I think you said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Aside me, there is no path to God. It's not perfect, but I think it was the I am the way, the truth, and the light.
Right. So other than me, there's no path to God. Something like that, right? So that's sort of analogous in many spiritual traditions. They'll say, this is the way. But the way is a long way. It's a long path, right? So there may be some point in time when that is the most important thing, mindfulness, say, for instance. But there are other quotations from Buddhist scriptures that say, this is the way, this is the most important thing. In fact, the literature that some of you have studied maybe for years is called the stages of the path, right? Lam Rim. Lam means way or path. So there are stages of the path. So obviously, mindfulness is useful at one point, but it is not the the end all, not the entire path. For a certain point of time, Lama Sopa Rinpoche, I remember when I was at Kopan, he received teachings on a tantric practice called Chö. Have some of you heard of Chö? How is it translated, Donna, into English? How do they translate it? Cutting off or slaying. Chöbo means to cut. Okay. Chö is a practice. Maybe you've seen Lama Zopa with a huge damru drum. You know what this hand drum? But not just a little one that they hold in the hand, really big one, and making that sound and blowing a thigh bone trumpet made from the thigh of a human being. Does that conjure up some memory? Elise, have you ever seen River Shapes? Tenzin Lama? You've seen that, right? Yes?
I haven't seen it personally.
Okay. Okay. So when Rinpoche received this teaching, it's very, very, a lot of practitioners, you know, they take that as their main practice. What's the purpose of that? It's because what one is trying to do is imagine giving one's body away to the spirits, you know, as though all your flesh and blood are offered in a certain way, all your bones and white elements of your body are offered in a skull cup and so forth, and giving rise to the sense of the ego. So it becomes very clear in your mind what the ego is, and then being able to slay that. It has nothing to do with self-flagellation or slaying yourself or something like this. What people would do would be to go to the charnel ground cemetery, where there would be fear arising. So the ego is already kind of prominent, and then imagine offering to the spirits there one's blood and flesh, one's bones and marrow and so forth. And in that process, you know, you're playing this drum, which kind of has an eerie kind of sound, and blowing a thigh bone trumpet, which is also kind of eerie, bringing up the ego. So Rinpoche was very, very fond of that practice, and practicing it all the time. And Lama Yeshe, when he was alive, said he put prohibitions on Lama Sopa how much he could practice to the exclusion of anything else. So there may be certain practices at a certain point in time that is our main practice. Maybe mindfulness might be our main practice at some time. Maybe compassion, or the wisdom that realizes emptiness, or the understanding of renunciation and so forth, the shortcomings of cyclic existence. So I'm giving a long answer to Nico's very well articulated short question, and I hope that he's not offended by that. So the short answer is that it's not, from the Buddhist perspective, it's not the end all. Kebje Song Rinpoche, who's the one who actually taught the to Lama Sopa Rinpoche, I asked him once why in the Mahayana tradition, say in the Tibetan tradition, we don't talk so much about these four close placements of mindfulness. Okay? You know, does anyone remember? Did I tell this story before at Kadampa Center? Does anyone remember what the answer he gave me was? Again, I can't see everyone. He said in the Mahayana, although that's a preliminary kind of practice along the way, the main object of mindfulness is the shortcomings of the self-cherishing thought and the great kindness of sentient beings, what we call the training of the mind, or lojong. So whatever you are doing, whether you're cleaning out the pots at the sink, you're washing the dishes, and you're thinking, like this, may I clean away the stains within the minds of all mother sentient beings who've been so kind to me in past lives, and actually having the feeling that you're affecting that, you're practicing that. So the various verses of the training of the mind, Song Rinpoche said, for the Mahayana aspirant, equivalent to the mindfulness, the four close placements of mindfulness, they would be mindful of those practices. Still a kind of mindfulness. So, you know, but not the four close placements of mindfulness. But at other points along the path, you need to develop renunciation. You need to develop bodhicitta, compassion and love. And you need to develop the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Nico, does that satisfy your question? Okay, thank you. Anyone else have an observation or question? Again, I have to, if you have, you can put up your hand like Nico did. Nico, you can take your hand down unless you have another question. Okay. Okay, so how to be happy in samsara. So in everyday life, what are we, when you encounter other living beings, when you encounter traffic, when you encounter the news, different kinds of emotions or klesha can rise. You can get irritated about the politics. Is there anyone here who's not irritated about politics? Okay, I don't see any hands. Maybe it's on the other screen. So that can cause irritation, then can become a cause of anger, right? Do you know how anger arises? Anger arises when you experience something which is unpleasant. Either physically, you're stung by the bee, or the knife cuts you, or you're slicing your tomatoes, or you experience something unpleasant or mentally unpleasant. Someone calls you a thief or a jerk, or you see people mindlessly imperiling the atmosphere, our climate, or criticizing people because of their religion or race, or so many things that can cause the mind to become unhappy. Once you have that unpleasant feeling of body or mind, and so unhappiness means unpleasant feeling of mind, right? We call that unhappiness. Once you have that and the mind begins to think about it, because the mind has become agitated, like the dirt coming from the bottom of the pond, other klesha arise, and you think inappropriately about that. That can give rise then to more than just a slight irritation, the actual development of anger. So the mind becomes even more agitated. I've mentioned, and maybe even in the Sunday class or at Raleigh, at Kadampa Center in previous years, the four methods of the Kadampa Geshes. So this is something you should, as Kadampa students, you should all know how to counteract anger. Felix, were you there when I talked about the four? No? Anyone remember? Robbie's walked out of the picture. I can't ask you. I think he must have heard before. Anyone? Okay. So it's worth mentioning again. Donna, you don't remember. Come on. So the Kadampa Geshes, they had sort of a way of enumerating the four main antidotes to anger. And when I start to say them, maybe someone will slap their head and say, oh, I remember now. Robbie, do you remember this four? Kadampa antidotes to anger. So one of them is called the arrow and the target. Does that ring a bell? Donna, what is that one we're talking about?
Well, I'm not going to be real clear, I think, but it's being able to, is the self the target and the arrow is the angry thoughts coming in and you're being able to kind of shield against them?
No, not so much. So here, I'll explain again so that you can leave an imprint in your mind. You remembered the name, but you didn't connect it with the meaning. So the idea is, this is talking about karma. If you say if you got your bow and arrow and you sling the arrow, if there is, if the arrow hits a target, it can only have happened if someone has shot the arrow, right? So if you had not created the karma in the past, like shooting the arrow, which is analogous to the continuing karmic seed on your consciousness, until it reaches the right opportunity, the karmic seed remains in your consciousness until an opportunity, a cooperative condition arises. And then when that cooperative condition arises, that karma can ripen as some kind of suffering. So the way to think about this is, when you experience something unpleasant, which has given rise to, you know, irritation and anger, resentment and so forth, you can think, I would not be experiencing this if I had not created the karma for it in the past. If I didn't shoot the arrow, it would not have, there would not be this present contact with the target, the cooperative condition. Does that make sense? Who can I ask? Arlene, what do you think? Does that make sense? No? You're nodding, but you don't want to unmute. You don't want to say anything more. Okay, that's enough. Peter, what do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I was just trying to think of an example. You know, one of the things that sort of makes me angry these days are the unvaccinated, for instance.
Right, me too.
You know, I just have no patience. And I realize it's due to ignorance, perhaps, on their part, but...
Okay, so there are these four antidotes. So let's see how this one would apply. When we talk about karma, we talk about individual and collective karma, right? Do you all know what that means? Kelsan Vrahi, do you know what the difference between individual and collective karma is?
I think so. I mean, collective karma would be, for example, we all as a nation and as a world have the collective karma to experience the pandemic. That's a collective. Individually, yeah. I might experience someone's harsh words.
Right. Oh, and individual, even though you have the collective karma to experience the pandemic, you might not have the individual karma to become infected. So like the example of an airplane that crashes, 499 people die and one person survives. So we would say sometime in the past, they had collectively created the karma to experience something violent like that. But one person or more, depending on how many people survive, one person during the course of the execution of that action in a past life, collectively, one person had sort of resisted, maybe given up, you know, like say bullying, say a bunch of kids are bullying an animal or beating an animal. And at a certain point, one of the children there or several of the children go along to a certain extent, but when they start to see the animal suffering, they recoil, they go away, they don't enjoy that, they don't rejoice in that. That would be an example of the collective situation is that they're all involved somehow peripherally in the bullying of the animal, beating of the animal. And in the future life, when that karma ripens collectively, they all experience some kind of, like say the plane crash, but those people that didn't fulfill all of the limbs of the karmic activity, they would not experience the final result. So someone survives the crash. They experience a crash, they're bumped up and everything, but they live through that. So we could understand maybe the pandemic, or say people not wearing masks that we in the past we have been oblivious of the harm that we might have caused others, Peter, collectively with all of these other people. But you know, so that can ripen as a kind of suffering on us right now. So we can point our finger. So the idea of this first point, the arrow and the target, is that rather than pointing your finger for the cause of the suffering outside, like those other ignorant people, or a politician or the person who's called you a bad name, or someone who's shortchanged you, or someone who's stolen from you or hit you or whatever, turning your attention away from that, because thinking that the other person is the sole cause of your suffering is an error from a Buddhist point of view. They are a cooperative cause. The ignorant people outside are also, not wearing masks are a cooperative cause of your irritation. But the primary cause is having created the karma in the past. So in so doing, you diffuse the situation. You're not placing the blame on the other person, the person who beats you. Like Shantideva says in the Bodhisattva Charyavatara, why should you get angry with a person? It's actually the stick that they're hitting you with that's causing you harm, right? You know this verse? I see some people kind of nodding. The Tenzin Lama, you know this verse? You know this idea?
Yes, I do. If a person's hitting you, you get angry with them. Why shouldn't you be angry instead with the stick? Because the stick's hitting you. And right. Then the teaching is that the anger is controlling the person just as the person is controlling the stick.
Exactly. So you can say, then you shouldn't be angry with the person either, because the anger that person is exhibiting and hitting you with the stick is what you should be angry at. You shouldn't be angry at the person. You should have, if you have any kind of sense, you would try to eliminate the anger in the other person, not by killing them, but by teaching them, by compassionately leading them to antidotes and so forth. So this first of the Kadampa methods, called the arrow and the target, it's mainly talking about karma, diffusing the situation by recognizing whatever that you've experienced that's uncomfortable, that suffering, is a result primarily of your own karma. The outer situation is just a cooperative condition, like the target. Even if the target were there, if we'd not shot the arrow in the past, if we hadn't created the karma, we wouldn't experience that suffering. Now, there's more to talk about that in terms of Peter's example of you could still feel some sense of compassion for others due to the fact that a lot of people are not wearing masks. But let's leave it at that for the time being. So second point, one of the exacerbating factors of anger is to think that the cause is out there. So the antidote to that is the arrow and the target, thinking that I've created the cause of that. Another exacerbating factor is thinking, oh man, this will never end. It's sort of like an intolerance, as though, when you've got a toothache and it's not changing moment, it doesn't seem to be changing moment by moment. And you feel irritated about that, or you're being abused or something. The antidote to that is meditation on impermanence, realizing that all these things that are problematic for us will eventually end. If you can see the end of something, sometimes it's a little more tolerable, right? If you don't see the end of it, if it just seems like it's going to continue, it becomes more intolerable, like a long prison sentence. If you're only in for a day, maybe you had a bender with Robbie and Don, and they got pulled in and put in the drunk tank. What is it called? No, that's never happened. But I'm joking. But if you know you're only going to be in there overnight, you can kind of, okay, I'll be out tomorrow. But a longer sentence, you may not see that so easily. So to meditate on impermanence, there's a very famous proverb, or I can't remember what you call it, that I remember reading in the Sufi literature, but it's found in almost every religion. And tell me if you've heard this before. This too will pass. Right? This too will pass. I remember, and if I tell this story, I'm sure someone will remember me telling this story before. When I was in Lebanon, Beirut, many years ago, teaching, a friend of mine and I, we rented a house up in the mountains, and we would go there on the weekends. So he was there a lot of the time. I would just come on the weekends from the school in Beirut. I'd take the taxi up to Shamloon, I think it was called. Anyway, unbeknownst to me, my friend was into sending back to his friends in America Lebanese hashish. Do you know what hashish is? Sort of like a very strong, I think, from the resin of the marijuana. So what they did is at Christmas time, he and another friend, they rolled out the hashish very thin layers and put aluminum foil on either side and sent it to their friends in America in Christmas cards to see if the customs interdict them. They got through, and so then they thought, okay, we're going to do it big time. And they hired a Lebanese carpenter to make pigeon cages for them. But the pigeon cages, the laths, you know, like the bars, were actually two pieces of plywood or two pieces of wood in between which they put the hashish. So the whole cage was, you know, a huge cache of narcotics. So somehow the Lebanese carpenter that they hired told the police about this, and they were raided. And to make a long story short, my friend Steve was caught by the police and put into prison. And I went to visit him at the prison in Beirut, where there were these big bars outside where one prisoner at a time could come out and see you in the courtyard. And I remember asking, because I could see he had been beaten up. He was a very handsome guy, probably been physically molested, you know, his first night there. And I asked him, how are you going? How are you doing? How is it? And he said, this too will pass. We had read together these Sufi aphorisms, I guess you'd call them, and that protected his mind at that point. You know, this too will pass. You know, I was very impressed by that, and I've always thought that was a good example for this. So we have the arrow in the target, which is talking about karma. We have meditation on impermanence. And then meditation on compassion. You know, for instance, we might think that the person who's done us harm and to whom we're developing resentment or vengeance or, you know, thoughts of retaliation, they deserve to be harmed. Or they're suitable to be harmed. What is it? I remember in the past when I first came back to the States, on watching some TV, I think it was the TV series Friends, that's still on TV. I think you can watch reruns of Friends from the 80s or 90s or whatever. and there was an expression people would use. Say, for instance, you got angry at someone at a party, and your friend said, "Oh, you shouldn't have done that," and you would say, "They deserved it." Or what is that the right phrase? Or what did they say? It's not exactly right. Something like that, right? Our mind thinks that that in certain circumstances it's okay to engage in anger because the other person deserves it. They've done something wrong, or they're lower than us. You know, in the case of all of the racial kind of animus that is going on in the States these days, like in Georgia, these three fellows who chased an African American boy and killed him. He was lower than us. You know, he deserved it in their own minds. So the state of mind of compassion is to help to diffuse the anger by meditating on compassion. If we've done something wrong, like say we've broken grandma's Ming vase, or precious, we spilled ink on, we spilled coffee, black coffee on the precious Persian carpet, and what we would like to think is for her to say, "Oh, don't worry about it. It's no problem." We never would like to experience even the smallest criticism or suffering from our own point of view. We would think that's correct, right? From our point of view. That's nice. In the same way, other sentient beings, they don't want to be abused if they've done something wrong. So to help to diffuse anger, to meditate on compassion. Making sense so far? Susan, what do you think?
It absolutely makes sense.
Okay. So in certain circumstances, one or the other of these three might be more appropriate, or all in sequence, because your mind may be holding to several of these factors. The fourth method was to meditate on the guru. What does that mean? So the arrow and the target, impermanence, compassion, and meditation on the guru. Usually, when we experience something that's unpleasant, something that's suffering, we think, "I don't need this." Oh, that's the expression I was thinking that from the friends, I think. When I got back to the States, I remember hearing, there was some argument. Someone starts arguing with you and you say, you just turn your back on them. You walk away and say, "I don't need this." Is that the expression? Is it, again, maybe the verbally is the one word different or something. Something like that. Actually, From a Buddhist perspective, when suffering arises, you can think, "I need this. This is a wake-up call. This is my guru. This person or the situation is my guru in teaching me the importance of patience, of teaching me about karma, teaching me about compassion, teaching me about impermanence and emptiness." So rather than, you know, thinking that I don't need this, to think this is something worthy of my calm appraisal, you know, without the klesha that causes the mind to become disturbed. This is a situation that is showing me the reality of cyclic existence. The very nature of cyclic existence, the very nature of samsara is suffering. Although, as we said, you know, there's some happiness, there's the good berries, concrete or whatever, you know, pizza, chocolate, you know, Bitcoin when it's going up, or you know, sexual encounter or whatever. But those are all contaminated happiness. They're not real happiness. It's just exchanging one suffering with another. The very nature of cyclic existence is suffering. At the first meditation course I attended at Kopan in 1974, I remember I was doing yoga in the mornings, and in the evening when we meditated, it was something a little bit like Tonglen. You imagine taking on the suffering, and I felt a pain in my heart. And I thought, oh, maybe this is a result of the yoga I'm doing. So I made an appointment to see Lama Zopa Rinpoche to ask him whether it was okay to do yoga, or that somehow that was contradictory. So this is not contradictory, of course, but I didn't know. And before I had the chance to have the interview, in one of the discourses Lama Zopa Rinpoche was giving at Kopan, one of these big tents, and there were 200 people, Rinpoche said, heart is the nature of fire. And like many of, maybe some of you, but partially paying attention, at that time I was kind of, you know, maybe looking around. But when he said, heart is the nature of fire, I suddenly paid attention. And he said, while you're in cyclic existence, it's unreasonable to expect that there will be no suffering. It's the very nature of cyclic existence to be suffering. So in knowing that, you can kind of just sort of like, what is it? I can't remember the common phrase, and I think freeze out or cool out or chill. You can kind of chill. You know, it's the nature of cyclic existence. So afterwards, we went out for, what's it called, some kind of soybean coffee or something like that in the, you know, the, at Kopan they're serving. And I said, wow, Rinpoche answered my question. I don't have to go see him. And they said, what did he say? What did he say? And I said, remember when he said heart is the nature of fire? And they all looked like, what? He didn't say heart is the nature of fire. He said heat is the nature of fire. Of course, you know, when you talk about fire, when you talk about fire is that which is hot and burning, right? Heat is the nature of fire. So to me, that's an example of the Buddha's speech, you know. Everyone hears what they needed to hear, you know, to calm their minds. It's one of the qualities of the Buddha's speech. So these are called the four methods of the Kadampa Geshes. So as Kadampa Center students, you should enshrine these. You should know these. If anyone asks you about the Kadampa Geshes, you say, whoa, the Kadampa Geshes had these four great antidotes to anger. So the arrow and the target. What did we say? Impermanence. You don't have to do it in this order, but usually karma comes first. You know, impermanence, compassion, and guru, to see the situation as teaching you, reminding you to practice the path. Okay? So we just have a couple minutes left. Anyone have any thoughts or comments? Corrections or doubts? Feel free.
Just one comment, Venerable George.
Yes.
When you say meditate on the guru, this is very similar to verse 6 of the 8 verses of mind training, where it says, when one whom I have benefited with great hope unreasonably hurts me very badly, I will learn to view that person as an excellent spiritual guide.
Yes. Yes. Good. Yeah. So, and of course, the 8 verses of Training of the Mind was written by, Langri Thongpa, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who was one of the Kadampa Geshes. And so it's quite appropriate that he would be mentioning that in that context. Anyone else? Good observation, Peter. Anyone else have a thought or observation? Neely.
So when you talk about the arrow and the target, would it be like, I like to think of things in short terms because it helps me to remember.
Right.
Is a good way to think of it is that we become the target of our own arrow.
Well, the suffering situation is like the impacting of the arrow with the target couldn't arise. The suffering situation couldn't arise if we hadn't shot the arrow, if we hadn't created the karma.
So the pain is the arrow. We're receiving the pain from our own arrow. So we become the target of our own arrow.
That we're experiencing, that is the root cause of our anger. Anger arises because we've experienced something unpleasant, whether it be pain or whatever, and our mind thinking about it inappropriately, this is other person's fault, or, this is intolerable, it will never end, or, the other person is suitable to be retaliated against, they're the enemy and rather than compassion, and that this has nothing for me that's good. I don't need this. All of these different factors can enter into what's called inappropriate attention. When you've experienced something unpleasant, the mind exacerbates the unpleasant nature and then gives rise to anger.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. So let's, as at the beginning, we tried to create some virtuous motivation. Maybe something similar to bodhicitta, thinking, that's my goal, my end goal. I'm going to be listening to the and participating, hearing, contemplating, meditating on the material this morning in order to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Even with the semblance of that thought, we may have created more virtuous karma this morning than most people create in their entire lives who never turn their mind to such thoughts. So sit comfortably again. See if you can recall that clear state of mind that's like the clear light nature of the mind. And within that, recall that we have created today, this morning, some virtuous karma, maybe very strong virtuous karma, which will definitely ripen within cyclic existence, sometimes in ways that will not be beneficial to us in the future, might arise as our being very attractive, in which case we give rise to pride or vanity, or we become very wealthy. If that merit had not been dedicated, it might give rise to miserliness and, again, pride and so forth. Think whatever way this karma ripens in the future, may it become the cause of my continued spiritual development from life to life up to and including the achievement of enlightenment. My own achievement of enlightenment, from which state I can effortlessly and spontaneously benefit sentient beings without error, perfectly, taking them out of suffering, leading them into everlasting happiness. Due to these merits, may I quickly become a Guru Buddha, and lead each and every sentient being into that very same state. Like the reins of a horse, if you don't hold the reins, the horse may go to its favorite cloister, its favorite clover field. But if you wanted to go a certain way, you pull the reins in a certain way. So dedication is a little bit like that, making a strong motivation, determination, may that ripen this way, like turning the reins toward the destination of enlightenment. Thank you very much. Essence, those are our meditations were kind of the essence of the prayers that you generally say. So thank you very much. I'll see some of you again on Wednesday. I'm taking Geshe-la's place on Wednesdays for the talks about the Lan Rim. And if you have time next Sunday, I'd love to see you again. Thank you very much for your good questions and your attention. And see you next week. Take care.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Thank you, Venerable George.
Pleasure. Take care. Bye.